It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, we're joined here today with somebody that was involved in the mobilization No Nazis at UF or the University of Florida. In Gainesville several days ago, as many people listening to this know, there was a large mobilization. Reports estimate between 1,000 and 2,000 people showed up to give Richard Spencer a bad time and all of his khaki pants wearing buddies that did manage to show up. And we're just going to get into it. So first, can you introduce yourself and maybe just say what your involvement was in this mobilization?
Yeah, so I'm Chad. I was one of the lead organizers of No Nazis at UF. I'm a student, and so it was a student-led coalition that also involved heavily community organizers as well.
Awesome. And just how did you all hear about this and kind of what led to the development of this large coalition that included a variety of groups?
Yeah, we heard about it like the week before school started for the semester. It just popped up on Facebook. A community organizer from Orlando made a Facebook event saying that, you know, Richard Spencer was coming here and that we had to protest. And so it was kind of just weird seeing that as the first instance of it. And so, you know, it was kind of like, okay, fact check, make sure he's actually coming. Like, what is this? But then, you know, once we pretty much got confirmation, like once that Facebook event was created, the school sent out like an official letter. And after that, I mean, I joined together. I've done community organizing work before. I joined together with some other students that I knew would care about this, that would want to protest or want to get the event canceled. So we formed like a really quick just coalition of students. And then from there, you know, worked with community organizers, radical community organizers, and other student organizations and just radical students.
Well, let me ask you this. The Southern Poverty Law Center, the SPLC, longtime quote-unquote extremist watchdog group, has put out a document encouraging students, advising them what to do if the alt-right comes on campus. And kind of what they put forward is that students should basically go to administrators and set up unity events, you know, away from the site. And basically ignore them, but also, you know, say their piece, but in a way that doesn't confront them, and basically rely on the school administration to kind of deal with these problems. I'm just curious. I mean, you had to have come up against some of those positions when you're getting ready and kind of like ringing the bell of alarm. So how did you get so many people to eventually become involved?
Yeah, I mean, I was only sent that article about 100 different times.
Okay.
Yeah, everybody loves the SPLC. But yeah, so that in particular, that non-engagement, but like community kind of solidarity event was probably our biggest obstacle in getting people to like involved in a direct action, an actual protest. Our stance from the beginning was that, you know, Richard Spencer shouldn't have a platform as a fascist, and that, you know, we wanted to cancel the event. And so we tried, you know, we went to the powers that be, the university administration. You know, we created petitions, tried to talk to the president, you know, working within the system. And it's very clear that the system simply does not care about us. The system isn't there to protect us as marginalized students. The system is there to uphold the systems that are already in place, like white supremacy and patriarchy. And so that's what they did. And we even had a march on the president's building, probably like 150 deep, a few days before the event was scheduled, to try and have a conversation with the president, you know, explain to him how dire this situation was for marginalized students and community members, not just with Richard Spencer coming, but with that state of emergency, with the incredible increased police presence that was going to be there. Like, this was going to put tons of people in danger, and that, you know, the best decision would be to cancel the event. But again, the powers that be didn't care. They didn't care to listen to us. He locked us out of the building, and put the building on lockdown for the rest of the week, and sent out just a representative to talk to us, that got nowhere. And so, you know, we did different events like that. The march, we did a press conference right before that. We did a teach-in the next night, to try and get people engaged. But the biggest thing, I think, was us spreading our message that, you know, non-engagement simply is not going to work. Fascists don't care about, like, their goal isn't to have some type of spectacle, right? That's what they tell us, is that if we go and protest, we're feeding into what they want. They want some type of spectacle. They want attention. They don't want attention from protesters. They want attention from potential recruits. And so by us protesting, by us not allowing him to have a platform, especially a platform unopposed, if there's nothing that we can do to completely shut down the event, but as long as we have, you know, that couple thousand people out there showing, you know, a force against fascism, it shows how weak he was. And it really did show how weak him and his supporters were, which, you know, stops or at least discourages people from joining this fascist movement, which is all about obtaining power.
What did you all say to those people that sent you, like, that Southern Poverty Law Center article? Like, what was your response to them basically saying, like, don't engage, you're only giving them what they want? I mean, that is such, like, a paternalistic, and usually it comes from people that have no actual experience in organizing, but just somehow right. that they have such insight that they want to tell you what you should do.
Yeah, I even got the fact that some people brought up the idea that their funding increases after protests, that, like, everybody's more sympathetic towards them, and so they get more money after we protest them. And so I pretty much asked for, like, actual tangible data showing things like that. Like, if you really think something like that is true, like, oh, prove it. Like, show me data that proves that somehow he increases recruits when we protest, or that he increases, you know, monetary funds. And there is no data to show that. But I went through the history of it. And so one of the professors that I work closely with, who's also a community organizer, he's a history professor. And so one of his things that he always harkened back to is the fact that, you know, if you actually look at the history of fascism, especially in the 20s and 30s in Italy and Germany, right, fascism isn't something that, like, was ignored and then completely went away. It was ignored and it grew and led to, you know, ethnic cleansing. And that's what would happen here if we simply ignored them. We just allow them a platform to grow their movement, to become stronger, to look stronger, which, you know, might be safer for us in the near future, like on the day of the event, but it only serves to further marginalize people in the community after the event.
Well, can you talk about, you know, you've kind of put the word out that people are going to mobilize for this. How did you actually go about building that coalition?
Yeah, I was actually reached out to by a few experienced community organizers. And so I kind of started the student-led portion of it. And then they had a meeting where they invited students to it. And they made it really clear at the meeting that, you know, they wanted this to be a student-led effort, that whatever students decided they wanted to move forward with, they would listen and help as much as possible. And so that first coalition meeting was very broad. We brought in a lot of liberal groups, and it didn't work out as much as we would have wanted it to. That first coalition kind of broke down in the first way that it was formed. But the more radical groups all stayed together and kept in contact and kind of formed a separate coalition, even though the first one didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And from there, you know, we just worked together, spreading awareness, flyering, canvassing, putting out statements, getting people's attention. And then as we like worked together, we had that like solid base of radical community organizations. And then we were able to bring in some more liberal groups as time went on to help and bring out numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very interesting dynamic, because I think a lot of people, when they talk about like building a coalition or, you know, bringing people together, in reality, it's like, I feel like what we really want is like, you know, everyday people to become involved. And oftentimes, like, especially liberal groups just like totally don't want that. They want a controlled, you know, quote unquote, nonviolent, whatever that actually means, event where nothing is disrupted, where you work with the police, which obviously like pushes away, you know, most people that actually want to do something. So I think it's kind of an interesting question. It's like, you know, certain groups will actually probably make something even smaller but then again, it's like, how do you actually reach out to all those networks of friends and different formations that will bring in, you know, massive amounts of people? Because it looked like there was a lot of students, but also just people from across the South and people from Gainesville actually showed up.
Right. Yeah, like that first coalition meeting actually broke down because of an argument about working with police from a liberal group. You know, we had a very set policy that you wouldn't speak to police during the events or leading up to, no collaboration with police, just as a very basic safety measure, right? And so that's not something that the liberal group wanted. And so it broke down that way. And so like it's important, because for this mobilization, we as radical community organizers understood that like our left here just didn't have the numbers and the capability to pull off something like that by ourselves. And so we didn't need to bring in some more liberal groups, especially ones with like larger populations, larger outreach, that could bring in simply people.
Right.
And so that's definitely something like that we had to do.
Well, I mean, what was the mood on campus when the administration of the university is talking about this massive buildup of, you know, police and all these different repressive forces, and they're trying to justify this? I mean, because it was so obvious on the day of. I mean, they were there to police the demonstration. They weren't there to, you know, keep people safe, you know, quote unquote. But they were there to facilitate the event. I mean, for all the talk of the university of how much they didn't like Richard Spencer and what he had to say, I mean, without them, there would have been no event. You know, he wouldn't have spoke. I mean, people just would have shut the event down or blocked the entrances.
Yeah. The police presence was really wild. We had people on the day of, or the day before, reporting that they saw like Aryan Brotherhood walking around campus armed, but it was really just the Florida Highway Patrol. Like that was the way that they were dressed. Right. And I mean, you couldn't tell the difference from a distance. And so like, it's very clear, that, you know, those police weren't there for us. We knew that prior to, but the way that the university talked about it was that, you know, it was a safety measure, that they were doing this for the safety of us, that the police would be there to protect us, all the bullshit that we've already heard before. And so that's definitely something, especially with the state of emergency put in place, where police essentially had like complete jurisdiction over the area. Like it was a mini police state, where they could do whatever they wanted to, and we were at their mercy. It was a very, very interesting situation to deal with. And I mean, something that we're still trying to hold university accountable for now.
You know, one of the other interesting things is that they never actually went to court, you know, and fought over this. I mean, basically, from my understanding, they threatened them, and then the university's like, all right, you know, you can have the event. I mean, do you want to just talk about that dynamic? I mean, there was no pushback from the university. They capitulated very quickly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as students, one of the things that we were asking for, right, was for them to cancel the event. And we understand the way that the First Amendment works, that there is always the threat of lawsuit there. But there's been 5 or 6 public universities across the nation that have canceled or denied Spencer from coming on campus, threatened with lawsuit because there's always that threat, but never had any actual repercussions, never being sued, never having to deal with Spencer again. I'm sure that threat of lawsuit is still there, but the fact that they could do that, get away with it, and move on meant that our university, the University of Florida, had that same ability. But even if, you know, they were going to be sued, us as students and community members and pretty much everyone that isn't a fascist would much rather them spend money on legal court fees than, you know, $600,000 on a mini police state.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point. It's like, why couldn't they have just rolled the dice? I mean, even if their whole plan was like, we're going to spend this money to prevent, you know, quote, property destruction. It's like, well, how many windows would people really break, you know? And it's also ironic because, I mean, the state of Florida has just gone through this horrible hurricane. I mean, people are still recovering, and to spend that much money and to see that much quick turnaround to police this thing and mobilize all these resources is just really, it's a slap in the face to everyone that was basically told, you know, get out or you're fucked.
It was not just that, but it was a huge slap in the face going back to the hurricane to OPS workers who didn't get paid for the time off during the hurricane, which, by the way, came out to about $500,000.
Jesus.
And then also within like the area surrounding the Phillips Center where the event was, they shut down so many of those buildings around there that, again, OPS workers the day of and the day before didn't work and missed out on another paycheck or missed out on another portion of their paycheck. And these are people that already live paycheck to paycheck, and they're missing out on these things so that we can allow a fascist to have a platform. And there's no way for them to recoup that money, except, I mean, we're working on it now, but, like, legally, like, they're not entitled to that money as of right now.
Right. Well, do you just want to talk about, you know, physically the day of, just what all happened, throwing aside any misconceptions that people may have heard about the day, what all went down?
Yeah. So our plan was to gather maybe about a half mile away from the venue couple hours, 2.5 hours before the event was scheduled to go on. We wanted to do that obviously because, you know, there's always the unknown of what exactly Richard Spencer was planning, if they were going to have some type of march and show of force. You know, we wanted to have people there ready to meet them if needed, but also because the ticket situation, the university handed over complete control over distribution of the tickets to the National Policy Institute, they got word of some local businesses trying to like protest the event by having people get tickets, bring them to the bar, and then giving them free beer for the tickets. We weren't involved in that. Our goal was prior to that to just spread by word of mouth, and it was working. Spread by word of mouth this idea to get those tickets and then hand them over to student protesters and organizers so that we could protest from the inside. And so that was our original plan. It was going great. And then the bars made this decision. And so even with that decision, we kind of pivoted really quick, contacted those bars, made sure that they were going to give us the tickets after they got them. So it was perfect. And then, of course...
Wait. So the bars... Because there was the story on Raw Story that came out that said, mm-hmm. like... It said, you know, we'll give you free beer if you get a ticket, but then you don't go, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. And so what happened is that the bars originally... There were a few bars in town that originally had that plan where they'll collect tickets there, rip them up, throw them away or whatever, and give you free beer. And so... to make sure that they didn't do that, because that runs the risk of them just letting people in anyways without a ticket. Right. We contacted all of those bars and made sure that they were going to give us the tickets instead of throwing them away so that we could then disperse them to protesters and organizers so that we could do it from the inside. And so it was beautiful. Like, it was coming together. Even though liberals were messing things up, like, we worked with them to fix it. And then the University of Florida fascist sympathizers, decided to give complete control over distribution of the tickets to National Policy Institute, which was going against their original contract that they had already signed, which said that the university would have complete control over distribution and that they would have to go through the, Phillips Center box office, and that they would only be in person, that they would be free. And so they were still in person and they were still free, but they weren't through the Phillips Center box office. And obviously National Policy Institute had complete control over those tickets and who got them. They were screening on the day of the event.
Yeah. How did they actually do that? Cause I mean, there was someone on Twitter that was saying, like, I was a journalist and I was with an African-American person and they denied me, so on and so forth. How were the NPI people deciding who would go in and who wouldn't?
Honestly, the NPI completely fucked up.
Really?
They did a terrible job of screening. I'm not sure exactly what they're looking for, but right.
Because the Daily Stormer was just like, you should go as a Nazi, but don't look like one, and like wear a disguise, and then come with the crew, and then somehow find the NPI people. It looked like a total shit show.
Yeah, I do know that they saw some people's jail support numbers, like on their arms visible, and those people they didn't let in. There was a definite point where they saw a jail support number, they kicked you out. And so also people that, like, there were a lot of, the punk scene in Gainesville is kind of big, and so there were a lot of very punk looking anarchists out there, that definitely were not allowed in. But they were screening, and I'm honestly not sure what their process was for that screening. Because they let in a decent amount of people of color, people of color that I worked with directly, to make sure that, you know, we are able to protest from the inside.
Well, also, what were they expecting? Like, the college Republicans on campus were going to march up and be like, you know, give us our tickets, comrade. And then that would be, like, the entire auditorium. I mean, I don't know what – or maybe they were expecting, like, a bunch of people would on their side would show up. Because it looked like from the photos that they had the, like, 20 or so people in two rows in the middle and then, like, some sprinkled people throughout the crowd that were just, you know, on their own.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, we're thinking that it had to do with them trying to change their persona, their, like, how they look in the media, right? And so they paint it as a free speech issue. they paint it as this intellectual debate that, you know, they'll be able to debate with anyone and win in this marketplace of ideas. And so I'm assuming that, you know, they were just trying to do that and let people in and think that they would have complete control over the event and somehow that would make them look better. Which, I mean, clearly it didn't. They don't win that intellectual debate. But even then, there's no reason to have an intellectual debate with them.
Right.
But yeah, so on that day of, we marched, and we marched around probably like 2 hours before the event began. And so that was an iffy decision. If I'm teasing myself, it was a little bit early, I think. But we decided to do it because people were gathered around. We maybe had like 400 people already gathered in that central area. People were getting antsy. You know, people can only stand around for so long before they want to do something, before they want to do what they came there to do.
Right.
And so we decided to march. And what was really weird and something that we didn't expect at all, because, you know, a lot of this is a guessing game. Despite us working with experienced community organizers, most of us had never done anything near this scale. And so it was especially not with the police presence that was there. Dealing with that and then dealing with the couple of thousand people, it's something that not a lot of us had experience with or experience with at all. And so we expected, you know, there was this prohibited items area where they had this ridiculous prohibited items list that included water bottles, masks, any type of bag, backpacks, umbrellas, megaphones, nothing like that was allowed near the actual events area. And so we expected to walk through like a police checkpoint, get searched, patted down, essentially not be allowed with anything but, you know, the clothes on our back and maybe a phone inside.
Right.
But the police really were pretty lenient. For instance, I was walking through and I had a bulge in my pocket from my phone. And the cop looked at it, saw that there was a phone in there. And instead of like making me take out my phone and show him to be sure it was a phone, he asked me what was in my pocket. I simply said a phone and he let me walk through. Which was really weird. Again, trying to figure out what exactly the police's purpose was there. Because it's clearly not safety if they're just letting people walk through with anything like that. They did confiscate like the clear items. Like, we were walking through with a megaphone. You can't hide a megaphone, so they took that.
Right.
But like the things that, you know, we could essentially, like, we didn't expect to be able to walk through with anything, but thinking back on it, you know, we really could have. And so that was a weird experience. And then we marched through the police barricade, the checkpoint there, and we got to the like actual area in front of the Phillips Center. And so we're still on like road area, and we have the ability to go into what is a police pen. It's literally set up as like a free speech zone, very easily corralled, very easily kettled in that area. And so, you know, as we get in front of this area, you know, us as organizers are like, okay, we don't want to do that. One, we don't want to get kettled, but two, you know, we're still organizing around getting those tickets or disrupting that ticketing process. So we need to stay mobile. We need to make sure that, you know, we can move easily once we get intel on where exactly those tickets are going to be available and when. But some people from the crowd were clamoring for us to go into this pen. And so, you know, with a large crowd like that, you can't control everyone. You can only, you know, give out directions or hope to marshal people, and, you know, hope that they trust you. And so I think what helped, one, is that I had gone on camera and put my name out there, at least my first name, prior to in that press conference and the march. And so I was a recognizable face as one of the leaders of the movement, and someone that, you know, was trustworthy, that people could look to and see, like, okay, he's been leading all of the things up to this point. He clearly knows what he's doing. And so whenever I would speak and had that ability to speak to the crowd, you know, a couple people, especially from out of town, didn't want to listen, and, you know, we're still telling people to go into the pen, but I would say 99% of the crowd was like, okay, he knows what he's doing. He has a plan. You know, they as organizers have a plan. Let's listen to them. Let's not go into that pen. I mean, I specifically told them, like, that is a police trap. They want us to go in there. So don't go in there. That we would need to stay mobile. That we had a plan for that. And so, you know, it did work out that, you know, we had that ability to stay mobile. One of the things that really helped with, you know, keeping everyone on the same page was chants. I'm a Dream Defender. And so a lot of the stuff that we do whenever we do, like, rallies, marches, any type of protesting, revolves around chants. Just as a really easy way to keep everyone on the same page and kind of boost morale. Because if you're just walking, people get bored. And so we had people leading chants, you know, differing chants, change it up. But it's an easy way to just, like, keep people engaged. And so we would lead a chant, and then we marched back down to the area where we were told that the tickets were going to be available. And so, again, like, going back to critiquing myself, I think that we went a little bit too early, because even though we marched all the way up there and then marched maybe like a block back down to where the tickets were going to be available, the tickets still weren't available yet. And so that's something that we would have wanted to time better. But of course, like, they had complete control of the distribution and when. And so it's a little bit of a guessing game. And, you know, you want to get out there early as possible so that you don't miss it. But so then we marched back down. We essentially just, like, took that intersection there, marched people around in a circle around that intersection. Again, staying mobile, but also just having this incredible show of force, of people against, you know, Nazis and fascism.
Right.
And then, from there, we were able to, you know, get comms information, told where the tickets were available, and march all those people right back really close at that point. March all those people right back to where the tickets were available and formula plan from there. We got a couple people inside really quick. And so once we got just a couple people, we were kind of worried that it was going to be some type of trap. Because what we were hearing is that there was, like, two rows of very clear fascists in there. But that was it. And so we were wondering why they were letting certain people in, you know, why they were only letting in a couple of us, but then not letting in some of us. And so it was really weird. We thought they were trying to, like, split us up, and then have, like, fascists come in, just fill the room and be kind of like a trap for the people inside. But, you know, it turns out that they just didn't have that much support there. And that once we got a couple people in, we pretty much just recruited as many people as possible. Like, hey, this is the plan. Go inside, get a ticket, go inside and meet up with these people. They were experienced Dream Defenders that I knew personally. So everyone I told them to go and meet them. And so, you know, from there, they really led it on the inside. There's not really much I can do from the outside besides push people in there.
Right.
And they took complete control over the event from the inside, which was beautiful to watch.
And what was that small group of neo-Nazis in the front? What were they doing the whole time? They must have been pretty uncomfortable while people were screaming, fuck you, Spencer, at the top of their lungs for over an hour.
Yeah, from what I saw, they were pretty uncomfortable, really pissed. from what I heard from people inside was that they were like neo-Nazis that saw how many people we had in there and literally just like freaked out, said, this is too much, there's too many communists, and walked out of the event. And so it was beautiful to hear. I mean, just like they really just like ran scared, which I mean is exactly what we wanted. That's like our vision prior to, you know, knowing that we were going to get those tickets on the day of the event. That's what we wanted to happen. We wanted to have more people in there, because the National Policy Institute didn't even distribute all of the tickets that were available. They maybe distributed like half of them. I think once they realized that they just didn't have supporters there, they cut off the distribution and stopped giving out tickets.
Oh, wow.
So that's why whenever you see like the live streams, the videos, it's almost like half empty because they just stopped giving out all the tickets.
Right. It wasn't a full event, you know. So you're saying that they thought, it seemed like that they would have a much bigger crowd of their supporters, which never materialized.
Right, exactly. It really didn't materialize, and they simply like were outnumbered significantly. Like I would say that they had maybe 50 there, and there were some dispersed throughout the crowd through the day, that like were very recognizable, but also there were definitely fascists agitating, walking through the crowd, that weren't as recognizable, but really, I mean, they were completely outnumbered.
Spencer has kind of denied that he cut his speech short. Do you just want to comment on that? I mean, did they end it before they said, from the video, it just seemed like they were totally upset the entire time, basically yelling at the crowd, you know, calling them babies, saying that they should be ashamed of themselves. Like, it seemed like a really bad substitute teacher that had gone to a school on the wrong side of the tracks that they were not used to, and that they basically spent like over an hour just like trying to get the class to pay attention to them, and no one gave a fuck.
That is a wonderful description. he definitely ended it like 30 minutes early.
Really?
He like was trying to get out, you know, his little speech, his ideology speech, and was shouted down the entire time. And so he opened it up for questions and answers, thinking somehow that would be better, and was ridiculed during the question and answer session. And so eventually just like shut it down 30 minutes early. Yeah.
Well, it's like they're interested in doing whatever it takes to get that like that level of buy-in to the crowd to engage them back. And it's like people just were not – seemed like people by and large were not interested in that. I mean, no one wanted to like have a debate with Richard Spencer. And it was funny because when it got to that point, their responses to the questions were just like they were shutting people down and making fun of them or trying to like – you know, all that stuff. They just looked totally stupid. And moreover, like Mike Enoch, you know, who's probably five times dumber than Richard Spencer is, you know, they just looked even dumber themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, people realized that they were Nazis and that, you know, we don't have to debate with them. That is not going to do anything. And that the point should just be to not allow them to have a platform. And that's exactly what they did on the inside.
Did the BuzzFeed article that came out, I mean, did that have any impact on this? Because, I mean, it was just amazing that a couple weeks before this thing happened, I mean, there's literally video footage of Richard Spencer and Mike Enoch. Mike Enoch was there as well, doing Nazi salutes while Milo is singing. You know, and that seemed, no one seemed to mention that.
I don't even know which article you're talking about. That really?
Oh.
That came out?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's. You should go back and read it. It came out in BuzzFeed. It was a big deal because what it showed was that Milo in 2016, when he wrote an article about the alt-right, kind of outlining it for traditional conservatives. Yeah, basically he was taking cues and talking and having white nationalists and neo-Nazis edit his stuff, and you know that was going up the chain to people in Breitbart, including Steve Bannon, and he had a deep relationship with somebody that's a neo-Nazi that's in these various circles. So I mean, it was a pretty big deal, and you know, it definitely showed. And part of that was a video of Milo singing a song at a Dallas bar, and then Richard Spencer and a bunch of other neo-Nazis are there, and they're all giving the Nazi salute.
I do remember what article you're talking about now. I'm not sure how much of an effect that had, except to show what most of us already knew.
Right.
But what I think did help is that we really tried to control the narrative, especially like in local media here prior to the event. We put out like letters to the editor, op-eds, statements from our pages, and then the press conference. And so we had these talking points, you know, talking about how they're fascist, how they don't need to have a platform, how the university needs to cancel the event, how it's not a free speech issue, all these other things. And so what was really cool on the day of the event, you know, those media people are just getting interviews from as many students, many people there as possible. And so I would listen in on some of the interviews, and they're interviewing like liberal students that I knew personally, that I've had conversations with, that definitely like did not have the same viewpoints. And yet they were regurgitating our talking points, which was just like really cool. Like obviously they listened to us and they understood like what our message was. And so one of the things that we really did well was, you know, explain why, you know, he doesn't deserve to have a platform, and that he doesn't need to have a platform, and that the university shouldn't provide that platform, and why it's our obligation, our duty as citizens to protest and not allow him to go unopposed, because the community really listened to that.
Right. Well, so he ends early. So then what happened? Did they just hightail it out of there?
Yeah. So from what we heard, there was a separate entrance for him and his supporters through the back. And so we never saw them go in, never saw them leave. However, a few of his supporters did come out through the front where all of us were gathered. And so there's like almost 2,000 of us there, maybe over 2,000. And they're trying to come out being, you know, police escorted outside of the event to safety. And what was really cool, and what I want to stress, is that they were ran out and shouted down by community members. Like, this wasn't, if you see the videos and you see them like running or getting punched or, you know, getting ran out of the event, that wasn't like us doing that as organizers. That was simply letting the crowd do what they do as a crowd, right? Like letting people express their anger and express their emotions in whatever way that they saw fit. And so we didn't think that it was important to, you know, one, we didn't need to lead those efforts. But two, it wasn't necessarily important for us to, you know, immediately go to the de-escalation tactics. There was one point where the Nazi, the one with the sideburns that got punched, he had like walked through. This was prior to the event, actually. This was like while the event was happening. He went through the pen, where a lot of people were gathered, and was just like calling people slurs, walking around, just agitating, and then he like started walking out, and it created just like this huge rush of people, almost had the potential for like a stampede. And it was kind of dangerous, because there were people there that like weren't paying attention, And so almost got trampled over. And that was really the only time where I saw it fit to have any type of de-escalation. But that was really just, you know, moving people out of the way. They didn't want to be involved, so that they didn't get trampled on. But again, like, letting the crowd be the crowd, allow people to, you know, express their emotions. These are Nazis, right? If someone wants to punch a Nazi, that's their own decision. And as far as I'm concerned, they're acting in self-defense. And that's fine. And I don't think that as organizers, it was our job to, you know, impose our ideology on the crowd and on those individuals. And I think we did a good job of just allowing them to do what they wanted to do. And you saw videos of, you know, Nazis getting run out. One, I'm fairly certain, faked that he got maced.
Somebody did send us a message saying that they smelled mace in the air during that, and they're very sure that it's real.
See, like, I was right there, and it was so exaggerative that I was like, okay, it's fake. But I have heard reports of someone else, like, in the area that got hit with mace as well. But, like, the weird thing was, if you watch the video, when he, like, turns back to the police, they look at his eyes, and his eyes are completely white, which, like, wouldn't make sense if he got maced. So it's possible that, like, maybe they sprayed it and he didn't actually get hit in the face or in the eyes. Something like that is probably what I would think would happen. But again, that situation was really weird, because it showed how much the police were not there for safety. He was very scared and turned back into the police to try and, like, get safety. And the police just pushed him into the crowd. Like, it was like, I mean, like, I wasn't complaining, but, like, it was really just weird to see. Like, the police are just like, it really seemed like they didn't want to be there and they were tired of the whole thing. And they were just, fuck it, just get away, like, get out.
If you look at that video, if you look at the officer's eyes, you can almost see them just, like, rolling.
Exactly,
because he's just like, what the fuck is going
exactly.
on?
Exactly.
Oh, man, it was funny.
Yeah, because he showed, like, a momentary concern, thinking that he got maced. And then once he looks at his eyes, he's like, get the fuck, like, get on. Like, he pushes him towards the crowd. Which was, I mean, again, like, I wasn't complaining about it, but it's like the police were clearly there only to, like, completely repress us if something happened. Right. Like, they weren't there for safety on, like, an individual level, but they were there. They had doubled barriers. They had snipers on every single building nearby. They had, you know, lines of police and highway patrol. They had National Guard offsite waiting. And so it was very clear that, you know, they were there to just have the full force of the state if we tried anything too much. But that they weren't there on, like, that individual small scale stuff.
Right. Well, you know, we're laughing about this now, but the day itself kind of ended on a very scary and frightening note with three people. Two of them were brothers, the Fears brothers, William Fears, and another one, and another guy, name escapes me, that actually shot the gun. They were involved in the Patriot Front organization from Texas. They had driven out to the event. And according to a document that was leaked by the Atlanta Anti-Fascist Group, they were involved in the organizing and the planning of the event. I'm just curious, you know, what are your thoughts? What's your analysis of the shooting? How did that play out? What's it like on the ground, especially at the epicenter of that, just kind of like people dealing with that news, both in terms of the media, but also just how people are doing?
Yeah. It was a really, I would say a really sad way, but, you know, at least it was only a shot fired and there were no serious injuries or casualties. But a really terrible way to end what was a really good day. From what we understand, the guy that shot that took the shot, you know, was one of the people that was chased out earlier. He was in the video where he's trying to go through the crowd, and the crowd is so strong and so just not having it that he jumps over the police barrier so that he could be arrested, so that he didn't have to deal with the crowd. And so we watched him get arrested, very clearly not seriously arrested. They just escorted him out. And so, you know, after that, it's pretty clear that they were agitated, that they were annoyed, that they were frustrated, and, you know, decided to take that out on some protesters outside of the event. But again, you know, it shows how uncoordinated these people are. These people came in from Texas. They were also in Charlottesville. Like, these are the dangerous and violent people that we talked about leading up to the event that are going to be at all of the events like this. This is the ideology. This is an ideology that calls for ethnic cleansing is not one that could possibly be peaceful. So these are violent and dangerous people that at any, you know, momentary notice could do something like this. And so, you know, thankfully those people that, you know, were shot at weren't hit, and weren't seriously injured, at least physically. And so, you know, that is a positive, but it really paints why we should hold the administration of the university accountable, because we stressed to them that, you know, there was the possibility for things like this, and you pay $600,000 for security, and this happens a quarter mile outside of the events, and there's no security there. There's nobody to keep these people safe. They got out just out of complete luck.
Right.
And, you know, the media coverage of it, you know, the protesters that were the victims were smart about it, didn't get their, you know, let their info get out. And, you know, thankfully that was respected. As far as I know, that info is not out there. And so I had like tons of media members calling us, looking for that info, trying to get that info, trying to interview them. But the focus really shifted, from, you know, this protest that was peaceful, that was very successful, to, you know, dealing with, again, dangerous and violent people, in the aftermath of it.
Right. I think it's important to point out, though, that, I mean, we can't let the university kind of say, you know, this is why we had to spend so much money. It's like, no, it's like, actually, you are the ones that gave a cover to these people to engage in these type of activities. Just as in Berkeley, the people that showed up for Milo's so-called free speech week, I mean, went on to beat people in the street and harass students on the campus. I mean, the police presence and the university apparatus gave them cover for that. It didn't actually protect people. That's because the entire reason for all this stuff was never to protect students or community members, but in order to facilitate the event and stop people from actually organizing and shutting them down.
Exactly. I mean, if anything, us as protesters did much more to ensure the safety of people there, even at times, sadly, Nazis, than the police did. I mean, you saw, like we just talked about it, the police pushing the one dude back into the crowd. Like, it's clear that they're not there, you know, for any type of safety purposes, but to, you know, take down any type of large scale protest that would go beyond, you know, just human interaction. From what we understand, they were really there to protect property, which, of course, we know that's what police in this country do. They protect, you know, private property. And so, yeah, like the administration very quickly switched their platform to, oh, yeah, we're so proud of the protesters for doing exactly what we wanted them to do and what they're supposed to do. And, you know, we support them 100%. We're so glad the police were there to make sure everyone was safe. And, you know, it's this complete just liberal bullshit mindset where they weren't even there, obviously. So they have no idea what actually happened. But then, you know, just this idea that somehow the police were there to protect us, largely, you know, marginalized community members and students who understand that police are never there to protect us, is ridiculous the way the administration prints that out.
Right. Even here today, there's an article that was published on the Southern Poverty Law Center's blog. It says, quote, students and residents mounted a peaceful protest at the University of Florida that threw Richard Spencer through a loop, exposing the hollowness of his message and the fragility of his ego, end quote. And the title reads, Gainesville deals a blow to white supremacist Richard Spencer's college campus strategy, which is hilarious because it's like, again, this is exactly the opposite of what the SPLC told people to do. They said, don't engage with these things, you know, leave them alone, let the authorities handle it, and if you must, you know, do some little side rally that distracts people from engaging with them. It's very ironic, as you point out, that I mean, these people are almost better at going back and rewriting their history than the alt-right was, because if you look at, you know, alt-right.com and the Daily Storm are both of the two websites that really promoted this thing, and also Unite the Right as well. It took them about a day to even kind of mention the shooting. They had to really kind of come up with how they were going to deal with it. And both of those websites, at least they realized, like, this is a huge blow. Because, like you said before, they really wanted to come out of this as, you know, very peaceful and well-organized, you know, learning their lessons from Unite the Right. Whereas now they seem to not only be more unpopular, but they, you know, the very people that they had come out to their event ended up almost killing three people at a bus stop.
Yeah, I mean, in the, like I said, like we've discussed, like in the aftermath of Charlottesville, you know, they understood how bad that made them look. Whenever you're trying to advocate for peaceful ethnic cleansing, which of course there's no such thing, but you know, if you want to paint that as some type of possibility, then, you know, you have to make it a free speech debate. You have to make it an intellectual thing. And so, you know, that's what they've been trying to do. That's what they've been trying to paint it as. But there's no getting around the fact that these are dangerous and violent, aggressive people that want us dead. And that, you know, they'll take steps to do that even at a bus stop in the aftermath of protests.
Right. You know, we've been talking for almost an hour here. I just want to sign off with a big question I think a lot of people are asking. I mean, the alt-right seems to be sort of in a downward spiral, at least, you know, a downward grade post-Charlottesville. I mean, it's going to be crazy to see what's going to happen in 4 days in Tennessee. The National Front is doing a demonstration there, but it does seem that they're losing steam. And in that downward spiral, I think we're going to see violence. We're going to see them kind of lash out. But I'm curious, how do we turn this, you know, this general anti-racist, anti-fascist energy into more than just directed at the Richard Spencers of the world? I mean, how could we use this kind of as a trajectory towards not only building up resistance and support and solidarity in our own communities, but also putting our ideas and our politics forward and, you know, putting that energy also towards the day-to-day struggles that, you know, structural white supremacy create every day, you know, deportations, evictions, capitalism in general, all that stuff.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, and that's what we're dealing with now in Gainesville. You know, after this huge win, we came together as a coalition specifically because of Richard Spencer, right? But we have this momentum, we have this structure in place, where we can work together as community organizers, despite having, you know, some differences in ideology at some points. We still have the same basic anti-capitalist, anti-imperialism, anti-patriarchy, understanding of, you know, we have to break down these systems of oppression. And so, you know, moving forward, despite having those slight ideological differences, there's still a lot of things that we can work together on. specifically building up community support and resistance, building up alternatives to, you know, the current systems that are in place. And so, you know, that's what we're working on now as a coalition, is to not just form around this, you know, very reactionary thing, and then, you know, wait until the next, you know, fascist comes to town, but, you know, use this momentum to now build, so that we build community support, we build community engagement, and we build actual alternatives for people within the community to fight back for themselves and to fight back with us, so that, you know, if anything like this ever happens again, one, we'll be stronger as a community, but two, even if something like this doesn't happen again, right, we're still working towards our eventual goal. We're working towards revolution. We're working towards, you know, having a better future, where we're not just reacting to different things, but actually, you know, working toward our eventual goal of not having a capitalist society.
Right. Because some people would say, it's like, you know, great, you've shadowed down Richard Spencer, but have you just redrawn the baseline of what American democracy is, which at the end of the day, you know, is settler colonialism, is all these different things. And how do we connect that to the Richard Spencers of the world with this broader critique and also this broader trajectory of action and mobilization and building relationships and all that? But, you know, as you talked about, it's a process, and we don't necessarily have the answer, but we're just trying to put it as we go forward.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a process, and, you know, something that we have to work towards as community organizers every day. But yeah, I mean, you know, that obviously takes different forms. People have different ideas of how that looks. But I think working together, even with that difference of ideology, you know, we can push each other on different, you know, theory, different ideas of what exactly or how exactly we should go about doing this. But as long as we're working together towards that eventual goal, I think that's what's important. And then, you know, pushing each other on ideological differences within that as well.
Right. Anything else you want to talk about? Any shout outs? Anything else you want to mention?
I do want to mention, because, you know, this is Richard Spencer's MO, going to university campuses, that, you know, if any other university students want help, want advice, that, you know, they just need to understand better the groundwork or the lay of the land and events like this, to please feel free to reach out to our Facebook or Twitter. Both of those are No Nazis at UF, and that we'll be more than happy to give advice, to give help, and if it's close, even mobilize a group to go and support, because, you know, after all, we are all fighting against fascism, and we need to help our comrades out as much as possible.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And it's just, I mean, it's great to hear of, you know, this mobilization and how positive it was, positive in a lot of senses, you know, both how determined people were, how loud they were, you know, how fierce they were, but also, you know, people coming together, and hopefully this energy continues forward. And thanks a lot for coming on the
program. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.